This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. You can now watch our TV show on Free Speech TV weekdays at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern. FSTV is on Dish Network, DirecTV, and Roku. Within weeks of a recently brokered ceasefire in Syria, there has been horrific violence. Over the weekend, U.S. airstrikes targeted an area near the Deir Azor airport, killing dozens of what turned out to be Syrian army soldiers fighting the Islamic State. The U.S. responded by saying it was a mistake. Then a major convoy of United Nations trucks carrying desperately needed food aid and medical supplies to rebel-controlled areas in Aleppo was bombed. The U.S. accused Russia of targeting the convoy. U.S. and Russian diplomats are at a high-level meeting this week. Secretary of State John Kerry has been unrelenting in his criticism of Russia's role in backing Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. But the U.S. is ostensibly in Syria to target ISIS, which Assad is also fighting. Human rights groups have pointed to the Assad regime as the greatest violator of human rights in Syria today. My guest is Reese Ehrlich, a veteran foreign correspondent, author of a number of books about the Middle East and war and the war on terror, including Inside Syria, the backstory of their civil war and what the world can expect, which is just now out in paperback. Welcome to the program, Reese.
Thank you so much, Sonali.
So first, what exactly did this ceasefire intend? It's just been not even 2 weeks into it. Who was it brokered by? And was the intent to basically have all sides take a break from fighting so that high-level diplomats could, you know, actually pave a pathway towards peace?
Well, it wasn't even that ambitious. The U.S. and Russia reached an agreement that called for a ceasefire that would last for at least 7 days. And that meant that neither side would, that controls their own troops, would be shooting at each other. After that, the U.S. and Russia were to jointly target Islamic State and al-Nusra fighters in an effort to have a common front against the extremist groups. And as well, part of the deal was to allow the shipment of relief supplies, food, medicine, and so on, into Aleppo and other besieged cities in Syria. It broke down almost immediately. Relief supplies were not allowed in. And of course, when the U.S. bombed the Syrian army base in Deir Ezzor, that completely flew things apart. And apparently now the one aid convoy that did come in from Turkey got destroyed from the air by Russian and or Syrian army military.
So what the U.S. did near Deir Ezzor, it was interesting to see just the media coverage of it. You know, basically, there was not that much in the West and in U.S. newspapers in particular. And everywhere there was media coverage, it was sort of cast as, well, this was a mistake. The U.S. basically undermined its diplomatic efforts. So this was a setback in the war against ISIS rather than this was a pretty horrible thing the U.S. did.
Well, just imagine for a moment that if the Russians had bombed...
Exactly.
Kurdish base or some other ally of the United States. Can you imagine the outrage? It's an act of war. We have to take retaliatory action, sanctions, blah, blah, blah. But when the U.S. does it, well, it was a mistake. What are you going to do? As a bit more information comes out, the U.S. military is not known for its transparency, but they had been watching this base for many hours and days prior to the attack and via satellite. And they should have been able to tell the difference between an Islamic State base and a Syrian army base. So at a minimum, it was a massive breakdown in intel. And it's quite possible that it was done intentionally by those who wanted to undercut the ceasefire agreement.
So what about the aid convoy? I mean, this is just such a horrific disaster to have trucks of United Nations food supplies, medical supplies go into these areas where it is desperately needed. I mean, this is aid. These weren't weapons. These weren't in any way, you know, any kind of supplies that would have helped the rebels other than to simply keep people alive through food. The U.S. is claiming Russia bombed the convoy. As far as you can tell, what really happened?
Well, I think we have to wait for more evidence, but apparently the attack did take place from the air. And the only people with air forces that would do something like that would be the Russian or the Syrian Air Force. And it was a horrific attack. And of course, the Russians and the Syrian government deny it. But, you know, the U.S. denied bombing the Syrian base as well. I think a perfectly logical explanation is that in retaliation for the bombing of the Syrian base, the Russian and our Syrian Air Force decided to attack the food convoy, thus guaranteeing that the ceasefire would collapse.
So at this point, what exactly is happening at the meeting where U.S. and Russian officials are meeting, basically face-to-face meetings between John Kerry, Sergey Lavrov? I mean, these are just two of many, many players, right, in this very complex war with overlapping allegiances and competing sets of enemies.
I suspect there's going to be a lot of yelling at any meeting that takes place because everybody's going to be accusing everybody else of having pulled the plug on the ceasefire. I think it was always a big if this ceasefire was going to work. And I just think at this point, I don't see how they can put it back together again. And the fact they're not the only players. The extremist groups such as the Islamic State and the al-Nusra never agreed to the ceasefire in the first place. So that was a big, big flaw in the problem. Turkey has now invaded Syria. It's the latest country to send its troops, claiming that it's doing so on a limited basis and to help bring peace. You know, everybody who's invaded, Russia, the US, Iran, everybody claims it's just going to be limited. Meanwhile, the Turks are stringing electrical lines from Turkey into northern Syria to maintain, you know, provide electricity. There's a lot of discussion that what the Turks are really after is not to go after the Islamic State, but to create a buffer zone, or a so-called no-fly zone, or a no-go zone, whatever you want to call it, inside Syria that would bolster their territory that they control and therefore the rebel groups that they back. So it just adds one more complication to an already quite complicated situation.
And what about this idea of a no-fly zone? It's been bandied about for a long time, almost since the Syrian war itself began, by various groups with, you know, differing outlines as to what it would be. But what sort of a role could a no-fly zone play? Could there be any positive side to it, given that there are lots of there's lots of machinery in the air from different countries dropping various types of bombs?
Well, the way it's portrayed in the West is always in the most nice, beneficial terms. It would be a place for civilians that they could go, that they wouldn't have to worry about getting barrel bombed and attacked by the Syrian Air Force. And they would get relief supplies provided by the UN. And it's always presented as this humanitarian effort. But if you stop and think about what would be involved, it's far from it. First of all, the U.S. and its allies would have to destroy the Syrian Air Force, bomb their runways, their bases, because in order to seize part of Syrian territory, you have to have the destruction of the Syrian Air Force. And the Russians are not particularly interested in seeing that happen. And the minute you started, anybody, the U.S. or anybody started that kind of a bombing campaign, they might very well come into conflict with Russia. And that has been, particularly since September last year when the Russians invaded, that's been the biggest factor prohibiting the establishment of that zone. The Turks they may advocate wanting to have such a no-fly zone, but actually implementing, they're not in any position to go up against the Russian army or Russian Air Force. And frankly, the United States is not interested in provoking that kind of conflict that would widen the war very, very considerably, including possibly outside the borders of Syria.
And of course, we should remember that the U.S. has in past wars used no-fly zones as a way to simply increase its own military supremacy over other factions. Now, what about this idea that any ceasefire, even one that doesn't last a very long time, can be positive because it can be the first of future ceasefires, that the symbolism is positive, that the idea that people will even temporarily lay down their weapons bodes well for the future?
Oh, absolutely. I'm in favor of ceasefires. A lot of people are getting killed unnecessarily in Syria, and anything that stops that, even for a period of time, anything that allows relief supplies to get through is a positive step. And the concept of all forces uniting against the Islamic State and the Nusra Front is not a bad one. Those folks are not going to accept any kind of political discussions. They're not interested in anything but brute dictatorial power for themselves, using Islam as the excuse. And they're going to have to be defeated politically as well as militarily. So that concept is not a bad one. The problem with the ceasefires and the peace plans that have been put forward so far is that neither the U.S. nor Russia nor the other parties can agree who is an extremist. Basically, the Assad government accuse anybody who takes up arms against them as being an extremist, Sunni, Wahhabist, Takfiri, and so on. And the U.S.-backed groups work militarily with groups like the Nusra Front and another one called Tahrir al-Sham, which all stand for creating an Islamic caliphate dictatorship in the region. So both sides can't agree on who's an extremist, so that makes fighting them almost impossible.
What about the fact that the Assad government itself has, as I mentioned, you know, so much documentation that it is the biggest violator of human rights, the biggest, source of the largest number of deaths, the barrel bombs, etc., and is intent on keeping its power regardless of whatever comes forward, even, you know, no matter who is in place. Even the U.S. is reluctant to be seen as siding with the Assad government for that reason. I mean, it just doesn't seem that any kind of real peace or just solution is possible in Syria without the Assad government in some way being held accountable for its horrific crimes. And I know this is not a very popular thing on the U.S. left to talk about, but frankly, you know, if he's guilty of barrel bombing masses of civilians, he's guilty.
Yeah, I think I agree. There are a small number of people on the left in this country who want to defend Assad as some kind of an anti-imperialist hero. He's fighting Israel, he's fighting the U.S., et cetera. I think it's just a mistaken view. The human rights atrocities are well documented. This is not just propaganda by the United States. You can find photos, a huge photo collection of tortured and jailed prisoners and executed prisoners that was done by a guy on the inside who escaped and went into exile and published his photos. The barrel bombing is well known. I interviewed Hezbollah fighters who are allies of the Syrian government, who said that when they were fighting in one jointly with the Syrian army in one city, a single sniper, rebel sniper on top of a building, the Syrian army would come in and level the entire building, both as a sign of their atrocities, but also their incompetence. The Hezbollah people said they were much more selective in how they fought the rebels. So even from their own allies, the Assad folks come under criticism. So there's no justification for backing or trying to justify what Assad is doing, any more than you could justify what Saddam Hussein was doing in Iraq, while you could at the same time call for no war by the United States.
Right. I mean, it's possible for us and certainly is imperative for us to take complex and nuanced positions, especially when ordinary people's lives are at stake. So many ordinary civilians suffering within Syria, and the U.S. Blundering into it with this goal of eradicating the Islamic State, which is one aspect of a large and complex war, and then this so-called mistake that it just did over the weekend where it ended up killing a bunch of Assad's soldiers, just goes to show that, you can't bomb your way out of these problems. What do you think the UN's role can be, Reese? I mean, the UN has been trying to focus at least on humanitarian aid, and now that convoy was bombed, it doesn't seem to have much space to actually broker any kind of real peace.
Yeah, the UN has been and continues to be in a very, very difficult situation. They don't have an armed wing that is fighting in Syria. They rely
on... Which is good, I mean.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I'm not calling for UN right. armed either.
Although, arguably, their peacekeepers and other wars have been seen as war fighters, but that's another topic.
If there's a settlement and everybody wants peacekeepers in there, that's one thing. But sending in aggressive troops to fight for a particular side would obviously be a bad idea. So the UN apparently now has stopped all humanitarian aid efforts as a result of the destruction of the convoy. We'll see if that resumes. The UN plays a vital role, certainly in the refugee camps, in dealing with the millions of Syrians who have been forced to flee the country. I've personally visited three or four of the camps now, and under very difficult circumstances, they're providing food and education and so on. Ironically, the U.S. has billions of dollars available for bombing Syria and has not fulfilled its requirements, its pledges, for helping refugees in Jordan. I did a story out of the Za'atari camp. They don't have enough money to function the way they need to, and the U.S. is included among those who are not paying up their share.
There's always money for fighting wars, never enough to actually help ordinary people. Well, Rhys, if the UN now has stopped sending in aid, what does that mean for ordinary Syrians? Are we basically witnessing a slow starvation of people, particularly those who might be trapped in areas that are either controlled by the rebels or simply being bombarded every day by coalition forces or government forces?
Well, you have to look at different parts of the country,
yeah.
And the situation is different. It's not like there's a massive famine crisis and everybody's going to starve. Frankly, the UN was not able to do that much even before they halted the aid because they couldn't get into, for example, areas controlled by the Islamic State, and they were severely restricted in areas controlled by the government, by the Assad government. And so the people in Syria are surviving. You know, there is some manner of economy going. There's people are growing crops and doing their businesses and getting paid, et cetera, et cetera. So it's not on the verge of total collapse and starvation. It's just a very slow, very bad human rights situation. And a lot of folks have been forced out of their homes, to have been displaced inside Syria. And of course, lots of people are still fleeing to Jordan, Lebanon, and Turkey.
Rhys, we've, of course, criticized the U.S. role in a complex war, making it even more complex. But if the U.S. were to try to take a more constructive role, using its military supremacy in a positive way, putting aside the problems with that for a second, we still have Russia and Turkey, as you mentioned, and the U.S. and Russia in particular have had tensions between them like we have not seen since the Cold War. Russia has very strongly decided to back the Syrian regime. Oh, and then there's Iran as well, of course. So given the situation as it is today, if you had John Kerry's ear this week at the meetings with Russia, what would you advise him to do?
I'd say, John, come here for a second. We got to talk. You know, this thing's gone on too far. When you first started bombing in Syria, you said, no troops on the ground, no combat troops. Well, we got 500 there. No troops going back to Iraq. Well, we got 5,000 there. You know something? The military solution doesn't work. And in fact, it inspires people to engage in terrorist activities in Europe and in the United States. It makes the situation worse. So what you've got to do is sit down with the Turks, the Saudis, the Israelis, the Russians, the Iranians, everybody who's got troops or is arming one rebel group or another, and tell them, the U.S. is pulling out. We expect you to do the same. The only way this is going to be solved is if all the foreign powers get out and the Syrian people themselves are able to reach a political settlement. And I'm going to take the first step by pulling out the U.S. troops. That's what I tell him. And then he'd start laughing.
Well, Rhys, I would certainly back you for a diplomatic role, given your many, many years of experience and knowledge of the area firsthand. I want to thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Always a pleasure.
Rhys Erlich is a veteran foreign correspondent, author of a number of books about the Middle East and the War on Terror. And his book about Syria, called Inside Syria, The Backstory of Their Civil War and What the World Can Expect, is just now out in paperback. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. By the way, you can sign up for our newsletter at risingupwithsonali.com to get daily emails with links to all our stories.